Our guest this morning is Dr. Rick Hansen. Rick is a neuropsychologist and an authority on self-directed neuroplasticity. I understand to be the effect of attention, thought, and behavior on brain structure and the quality of one's life experience. Rick is the author of several books, most recently Hardwiring Happiness. He's also a meditation teacher, founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. Among other duties, has served on the board of Spirit Rock, been a trustee of Saybrook University, and an advisory board member of Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. He's also been an invited speaker at Oxford, Stanford, and Harvard, and has taught in meditation centers worldwide. One of his earlier books refers to developing a Buddha brain, and I'm eager to hear more about that. So, Rick, maybe you can set some context by just telling us what neuropsychology is about.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you again for that kind introduction. You know, I like the teaching. One of my teachers along the way said that the I is a fictional character. So anyway, in that context, I'll try to proceed. Well, but fundamentally, a neuropsychologist is kind of a fancy term for a psychologist, essentially someone who is very engaged with the intersection between the mind and the brain. And psychologists tend to focus more on the mental sphere, uses pure thoughts and feelings, sort of irrespective to or not explicitly related to what's happening in the meat, as it were, of the brain. Neurologists tend to focus on the meat itself, the nervous system and so forth, and neuropsychologists focus on the intersection. I think of that a little bit as like that boundary zone that's so fertile between, for example, the sea and the land, which is where life probably originated, if not in the boundary zones between those volcanic vents at the bottom of the ocean and the sea itself. So that's what I do. And mostly what I do is focus not so much on what many neuropsychologists do, which is damage or injury, which is, of course, extremely important, such as stroke or concussion, things like that. But my focus is more on normal range experiences and the upper reaches of human potential and how to, in effect, bottom line it, use the mind to change the brain in very targeted ways to change the mind itself.
To start with, we often like to hear a bit about the journey of our guests. So for that, I'm going to turn it over to my co-host, Anne.
Thank you, Bill, and welcome, Rick. And it's just a joy to be on this call with everyone. And, Rick, I've had the pleasure to read your new book, Hardwiring Happiness, and it's so enjoying it. And what caught me was really some of your early experiences and when you speak of your experience in college and really stumbling on how to take in the good and how some of those experience in your early life have really informed your journey as a neuropsychologist and a meditation teacher. And I thought it would be lovely to kind of share maybe a couple of stories of how that came into your life and how it kind of brought you to where you are today.
Oh, thank you. And greetings to Ann and Bill, who I both know from our sitting group. Well, let's see. A couple of things here. So first off, I think like a lot of people, my sense of the world and myself as a little boy, my various earliest memories, sort of in the wallpaper, if you will, kind of the background tone or frame of them. And again, I think for many, many people, what was present there really has been very foundational for me in my life. And one of the things that was very present was this strong sense that there was much more suffering in the world than there really needed to be. In other words, this wasn't verbalized in a conceptual way in the mind of a 3- or 5-year-old, but there was a very strong sense then, and I can recognize it when I replay those early memories, that there's just a lot of needless hassle and bickering and fault-finding and tension and, you know, pushiness and conflict and just nothing horrible. I grew up in a very ordinary American sort of middle class, if not lower middle class, suburban environment in Southern California. I grew up in an intact home. I wasn't abused. I didn't grow up in poverty and complete chaos and disorder. So even in that fairly good from a material standpoint framework, I just felt deeply and longed for that there could be more true happiness than I was seeing around me. I was seeing people suck the happiness out of the air, willy-nilly, right and left, me included. So what to do about it? I didn't know what to do about it, but I was very motivated to try to do something about it in at least one of those three, you know, domains of intervention, if you will, out there in the world or in the body or in the mind. So then years passed, and two things happened. One is that in my home, in which my parents were loving and decent, certainly they were quite poor at empathy. So I had many experiences as in my family of just totally not feeling seen for what I was or who I was. And then going to school, I was very young going through school. I have a very late birthday, late in October, and I also have, I skipped a grade. So I was this kind of scrawny, anxious, skinny kid with glasses, quite introverted, a serious dork, going through school. And consequently, I also had many experiences there of being excluded, put down, dismissed, devalued, intimidated, somewhat threatened, and so forth. Again, nothing horrible, kind of trivial relative to what many people experience, but still, as I said in the very beginning, causes have effects, processes and their causes, right? So we all need healthy supplies. Psychologists, therapists call them healthy narcissistic supplies, in which we feel, as the most social species on the planet, we feel seen, appreciated, prized, wanted, if you will. And when we don't get that, it's like trying to breathe through a straw. You can get enough air, but it's just not enough, and you end up feeling like there's something hollow inside you that wants more. Okay, then I got to college, and there in college, and I don't know why, I began to notice two things. One, I began to realize that when the objective conditions were present, in other words, when it was factually true that there was some bit of good news in my world, you know, that I was included, I was wanted. Some guys would say, hey, let's go get pizza. A girl might smile at me in the elevator. You know, a teacher would praise me in front of the class, or I'd be invited to do something, my roommate, you know, in my dorm would be interested in what I was saying. Just little stuff on the 0 to 10 scale, small stuff, but at least the fact was there. Okay, and then I realized that I could let myself actually experience it. So first I had to notice the good fact, and then second I had to experience it, and then most important of all, the thing I really learned was that I had to let the experience sink in. I couldn't just have a brief experience that flowed through my mind like water through a sieve, but if I stayed with it for 10 seconds or 20 or even 30 and kind of noticed what it felt like in my body, brought a lot of mindfulness to bear, stayed with the sensations, protected it, didn't suddenly, you know, distract myself to something else or beat myself up in some way, just let myself have this experience that I'd actually earned. It was based on reality. Well, then what it felt like was that bit by bit, drop by drop, I was filling that big hole in my heart. And any single time I did that was fairly small, but the gradual accumulation was quite profound. And that set me on a journey in many ways and started creating a lot of positive cycles in which I would take in the good in a small way, which would make me a little bit more confident, which would lead me to do little things that would create more good in my world, which gave me more opportunities to take in the good, in, as I said, a nice positive cycle. So to kind of sum up then, looking back now, I've realized in starting the last 10, 20 years or so, especially the last 10 or so, that as a neuropsychologist, thinking about what Bill mentioned in the beginning as experience-dependent neuroplasticity, the idea that the mind is continually sculpting the brain for better or worse, I realized that I'd been gradually sculpting my brain for the better, that I'd been gradually internalizing these positive experiences and, in effect, not wasting them on my brain. And that's gotten me very interested in one of the three major ways to practice, to work with the mind, the aspect of cultivation, where we're essentially growing inner strengths inside, very broadly defined, inner strengths like mindfulness, happiness, resilience, moral commitments, choosing sobriety, knowing how to navigate a tricky conversation, whatever. The key question, really, I think in practice, in many ways, is how to grow inner strengths, including the strength that can simply witness our experience without identifying with it. And that has taken me to, and I'm sure we'll get into, so a recognition of the ways in which the brain is very good at learning from bad experiences, but it's comparatively bad at learning from good ones. In other words, the brain is really good at turning negative states into negative traits, but the brain is relatively poor at turning positive states into positive traits. So it needs some help. And that's become my focus recently, how to actually help people very effectively harvest half a dozen times a day in the flow of daily life, harvest a good moment so that they can gradually fill themselves up with it. And I think this is critically important, by the way, for people who are involved in service work. Otherwise, we, you know, have caregiver burnout, compassion fatigue, things like that. So to me, it's really important to keep, you know, filling ourselves up for the long, long journey.
And Rick, what I wanted also to bring up was the synchronicity between your work and kind of the premises and principles behind Service Space. And, you know, there's so many opportunities to serve and practice kindness and generosity. And just, you know, personally, when I first was introduced to Service Space and started to volunteer at Karma Kitchen, I was just blown away by how, you know, just serving a meal made me so profoundly happy, and just being in my heart all day. I would come home that evening and my children would just hug me and wouldn't let go of me. And I was so, I had to really take that in of, my goodness, what's happening inside me, because I feel this shift occurring, and it was so profound. But it was, you know, like you say, you know, holding on to those experiences that are so positive and absorbing them and really taking them in. And I'm just, you know, I just think in our community that so many of us can really relate to what you're saying, and we feel so fortunate to have the opportunity to really practice on a daily basis, you know, through service.
That's so true. Absolutely.
Yeah, Rick, you touched on something earlier that heard you refer to as a negativity bias in other talks, and I think that was really significant. Most of us on the call are probably meditators, and many of us probably struggle with obsessive thoughts or negative thoughts while we're meditating, and just wonder why we're so predisposed to think of the negative.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, okay, so on that's a really powerful takeaway from evolutionary neuropsychology, and it's this idea that as the nervous system evolved over 600 million years, our ancestors needed to both get carrots and avoid sticks, as it were. Carrots being food, mating opportunities, things like that. Sticks being predators, natural hazards, aggression between bands or inside bands, or just being in the social hierarchies, let's say, of primate bands or early hominid bands or even human bands, just being, you know, pushed to the side and losing that opportunity to pass on your genes. So, you know, of the two, they're both important, but sticks have more consequences for survival, for living to see the sunrise, for passing on genes that pass on genes. Because if you fail to get a carrot, as it were, today, you'll have a chance at one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid that stick today, whack! No more carrots forever. So the brain now has a bias that looks for bad news over positive news. You know, as they say in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads, right? So we're continually scanning for a thread or loss or some kind of issue that's interpersonal. And then second, when we find it, what the brain does perceptually is it isolates down on that one tile in the overall mosaic of reality and tends to not see the whole picture. And then what the brain does, third, is it overreacts to that negative tile. For example, if you play two sounds for a person, equally loud, except one is pleasant and one is unpleasant, the brain literally will activate more globally to the unpleasant sound. And then fourth, we fast-track that whole package of stimulus and overreaction into emotional memory. Once burned, twice shy, right? Never forget. So consequently, people are much more motivated to avoid losing something than gaining an equivalent reward. People also remember negative information about somebody much more readily than positive information. One reason why political ads tend to go negative. Negative interactions are more consequential. They have more impact than positive interactions usually in a relationship, which is why studies show that we tend to need at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions. That's a cautionary tale, right? To think about the last day or week or two, you know, in a relationship. Also, it's incredibly easy to train people in helplessness, which is, for me, very relevant to service work, both the doing of it and the people that we're working with. just a handful of experiences of inescapable pain will tend to train mammals, including complicated ones like dogs or humans, into a sense of futility, entrapment, and defeat. And they acquire what's called learned helplessness. And then it takes many times as many counterexamples of some sense of being a hammer instead of a nail to gradually accumulate, to regain your sense of efficacy or agency. So those are many of the examples of a negativity bias. You could just kind of think about a relationship, in which 10 things, say, happen in a day, you know, with that person, 5 are positive, 4 are neutral, 1's negative. What's the one you think about before you fall asleep, right? So bottom line, I sum it up by saying that the brain is like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. And while it's really important, obviously, to see the real threats out there in the world, both the immediate ones and the slower boiling ones, obviously, like global warming, global climate change, gradual increasing of wealth inequality in the United States and in other areas of the developed world as well, for example. These are, you know, whether it's slow or fast, we need to see, of course, the negatives. On the other hand, we've already got a brain that tends to be, on average, there's some exceptions, most people are this way, on average zeroed in on the negative. Meanwhile, if we want to grow inner strengths inside, we need to both have positive experiences of those strengths, and then, most importantly of all, install those experiences in our brain. In other words, we can't just activate positive experiences. We actually have to install them for them to sink in, to turn into neural structure. Otherwise, they have no lasting value. They're momentarily pleasant, but they don't help us over the long haul. So in effect, the brain has this design feature that helped our ancestors survive, but today is like a design bug in the 21st century. It's very good at internalizing negative experiences, but it's poor at internalizing positive ones, even though positive experiences that are internalized are the primary source of the inner strengths of happiness, resilience, loving-kindness, compassion, commitment to justice, etc., that we do want to cultivate in ourselves and other people, including our children. So as a meditator, to bring it right there, Bill, it's natural to be negative. And so appreciating that, I think, can help us not create secondary reactions, as it were, you know, as the Buddha called it, second, third, and fourth darts, in response to the first dart of the negative thought or feeling. I think the way to be with the negative thought or feeling is, first of all, to witness it. You know, just be with it. Don't try to change it. Hold it in a vast and open space. Investigate it. Try to unpack it, you know, sensing into the thought component, the emotional component, the attitudinal component, the body sensation component, whatever. See it's, as it were, emptiness as an experience. It's kind of insubstantial, and it arises dependently, and it will eventually pass away. And, in effect, don't get our knickers in a twist about the particular negative content. And then second, as appropriate, do what we can to release it. You know, see through it, exhale, help the body relax, let the feelings flow, challenge the negative thought, remind ourselves, no, that isn't actually true, for example. And then in particular, open increasingly to positive experiences, including the open space of awareness that holds the negative. That itself is a positive experience. And also we can open to other very traditionally known wholesome factors for everyday life and also certainly contemplative practice, wholesome factors like, you know, encouraging a little bit of warm-heartedness for ourselves and others, thinking back to Anne's comment about how much joy it gave her to be loving toward other people. You know, it really feeds us to be warm-hearted, whether it's to others or to bring a sense of compassion to ourselves or bring to mind the feeling of being cared about. We can also encourage some tranquility inside, gradually easing and relaxing, and even open to joy. It's interesting that traditionally various aspects of positive emotions, including intense ones, are seen as factors of steadiness of mind. So I guess that would be my take, as it were. You know, the negativity bias, it's there, but I think the fundamental action plan, in a sense, is to not underestimate the power of the dark side of the force, as it were, and to try to get out of reactive upsets as soon as we can, because the brain is overlearning from experiences of anxiety, irritation, sadness, and inadequacy. Not suppress those experiences, but disengage from them as rapidly as possible, stop fueling them for sure. Bad enough that they're happening in the mind, even worse that we're adding fuel to that fire. And then most importantly, repeatedly internalize, you know, a dozen times a day, if not more, half a minute or less at a time, you know, 5 minutes or so a day. Repeatedly internalize wholesome, appropriate, authentic, positive experiences, most of which are individually mild, to gradually cultivate an internal sense of unconditional peace, contentment, and love so that the negativity bias increasingly cannot invade the mind and remain, as the Buddha put it. And actually, increasingly, we start sensitizing our brain to the positive by repeatedly internalizing it. The brain can be sensitized either way, positively or negatively. In this case, we would be sensitizing it to the positive so that gradually over time, bit by bit, we develop a positivity bias so that, in effect, while still seeing the negative and mounting efforts against it and so forth, we have a brain that increasingly is like Velcro for the good and Teflon for the bad.
And Rick, I was wondering if you could also share with all of us the acronym that you came up with of HEAL.
Oh, sure.
And maybe even, I'm just reminded of Asha's conversation about physical exhaustion. And sometimes we, you know, I know just me personally, I've always had that sense of, gosh, my kids always say, you know, Mom, you always say you're so tired. And I realize it's for me, there's like a deep wound of sometimes like trying too hard, and so I'm actually not really acting from my true nature, but something that's kind of more forced, so I'm exhausted. But to be able to sit with the root of kind of our pain, you know, and I was just fascinated by your process with HEAL to kind of, you know, be able to include that, sometimes those deep wounds, so we can look at them. And again, bring that kind of positive experience to help heal them.
Oh, okay. Well, it's interesting you say that. My very first book is called Mother Nurture. Penguin published it in 2002. And it's really about supporting the well-being of mothers in body, mind, and intimate relationships over the long haul, not just during the postpartum period, you know, which is what most books are about. And so, you know, I personally think there is such a thing as a depleted mother syndrome that probably about a third of all mothers pass through. And some get stuck there. And it usually starts really accumulating, you know, as the kids actually get older or maybe a second or third child comes along. So anyway, you know, I have a personal feeling for that territory, and I think it's really important to keep filling up our own cup, you know, so we continue to have, you know, enough really for other people and we don't get worn out along the way. So in terms of your specific question, two-parter, first part, just like I said, there are three ways to engage the mind. You know, in the first way, we simply be with what's there. In the second, we release or reduce what's negative. And in the third, we grow or create or preserve what's positive. Those are the three ways to engage the mind. If the mind's like a garden, we could witness the garden, or we can pull weeds, or we can plant flowers. And, you know, some activities or combinations, a certain amount of cognitive therapy, for example, both pulls the weed of a negativistic thought and replaces it with the flower, as it were, of a positive one. But this model, I think, is a way to think about this stuff. So in the beginning, I think at first we simply hold the deep pain that you're talking about there, Anne. You know, that sense of drivenness around needing to, you know, always go to the max and kind of impose demands upon oneself that are to some extent probably a response to the perceived or actual demands of other people. So, you know, in the first way to engage the mind, we just be with it. We investigate it, we unpack it, we try to sense down to what's younger, more vulnerable, more central, but we're not trying to deliberately change it. That's great, right? And then at some point we move into letting it go as best we can. Sometimes simply witnessing it helps it release, but often we need to do something a little more active or deliberate in our mind to help something release. And then when it's time, we start growing flowers in the garden of the mind. And that's where the HEAL process comes in, that acronym, Anne, that you asked me to mention. It's a way for me to summarize the process of taking in the good. HEAL, H-E-A-L. H stands for have. We need to have a positive experience in the first place. We need to activate it. either because we simply notice one we're already having, which is typical, or, as appropriate, we deliberately create a positive experience. For example, by thinking of something that we're grateful for, or calling up a feeling of compassion or loving kindness for someone deliberately, or by calling up maybe a sense of determination or strength inside to deal with something challenging. All right, now we're having the positive experience. The rest of it is about installing this activated mental state into becoming a lasting neural trait. That's what learning is. That's what growth is. The gradual changing of the structures of the brain through lived experience with a brain that's biased toward changing for the worst based on negative experiences. So during the installation phase, in the HEAL acronym, H-E-A-L, E stands for enrich. That's the place where we draw upon one or more of five well-known factors in the neuropsychology of learning, including emotional learning, to really help the experience sink in, you know, a dozen seconds at a time. Those factors quickly are duration. You know, the longer we keep those neurons firing together, the more they're going to be wiring together, paraphrasing the famous saying from neuroscience that neurons that fire together wire together. So duration. Second factor is intensity. You know, the more intense the experience is, the more it tends to get encoded into neural structure. The third enriching factor is multimodality. In other words, the more that we can feel it in the body and have an emotional response, the more neural trace will be left behind. Fourth factor is novelty. The fresher the experience, the more we can look at the world and our own experiences, as it were, through the eyes of a child. You know, in the famous saying, beginner's mind, Zen mind. And then last, personal relevance. Why does this matter to me? How is this salient? Why should I care about this? How would it help me, for example, to really let it sink in that you care about me, or that I got something done today, or that it's beautiful outside, or that, you know, I do have some good qualities in my heart, right? How might that actually help me? That's personal relevance. So those are the five well-known enriching factors. And then A in the HEAL acronym stands for absorb, where you're priming and sensitizing memory systems by intending and sensing that the experience is really going into you. You're kind of revving them up. You're sensitizing them, getting them really ready to turn this mental state into a neural trait. So people do that in different ways. They kind of sense the experience coming into their body. Maybe they visualize a golden, soothing balm going in. With children, I'll talk about putting a jewel in the treasure chest of the heart. For me, in the absorb step, there's a kind of giving oneself over to the experience in a very intimate and receptive way, really receiving it. And then the optional fourth step of the taking in the good process, in the L for link step, that's where, if we choose, we can be aware of both the positive material that we've been engaging in the first three steps of have, enrich, and absorb. We can be aware of both that positive material in the foreground prominently in awareness, while at the same time, on the stage of awareness, as it were, off to the side in the wings, is some kind of negative material that the positive material is the natural antidote for. So, for example, if in the moment a person is feeling cared about, if they want it, they could also be aware of, let's say, other feelings of being not included or dismissed or mistreated, not seen. And since, quote-unquote, neurons that fire together wire together, that positive material would be going into the negative, gradually soothing it and even eventually replacing it. I think in life, as a longtime therapist, in the field we first tend to be very good at activating positive mental states, but we're not very deliberate about, in most cases with some interesting exceptions, we're not very good at installing them as neural traits in the brain, so we waste opportunities. You know, most of our clients' hard-won mental states are unfortunately wasted on the brain if they don't leave any lasting trace behind. And then second, also in psychology, psychotherapy, and I think related areas like coaching, training, human resources training, what have you, generally speaking as well, we tend to be pretty good at the first two ways to engage the mind, you know, being with it, mindfulness, open witnessing, and also pretty good at releasing the negative. But we tend to often not remember to do the third step, which is cultivating what's positive. But unfortunately, as any gardener knows, if you pull weeds, right, but don't replace them with flowers, those weeds grow back, especially in the context of a brain that, if it were like a garden, is very fertile for weeds, but stony ground for flowers. So that's why I think it's important to, you know, engage this whole heal process. Any single time you do it won't change your life, but the gradual accumulation, you know, bit by bit, the water pot is filled, and the brain will gradually change for the better.
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah. Actually, that leads to a question for me. Most of our talk has been about mental states and focus and attention, and I'm curious about the effect of acts of service in our community. Most of us are involved with some sort of service work and do physical actions. Well, I guess it goes without saying that they would help strengthen these positive states, but is there any research on the effects of physical action on brain structure?
Yeah. So two parts. First part, if you're experiencing anything, it's activated as a mental state, which entails an underlying neural state and repeated patterns of neural activity change neural structure. Okay, so if you're simply thinking about going skiing, you know, and imagining doing it, that's going to be activating some mental neural patterns, all right? So you might get some learning by visualizing, as it were, a ski run you're going to do, or by visualizing how you're going to navigate a difficult conversation, or imagining how you might, you know, serve people in some way. Okay, it's good. But if you were to do the act, if you're going to ski down that slope or play the piano or talk to the person for real or do the service for real, you're going to get a lot more neural activity, right? Lived experience. I mean, some people say that basically their brain evolved to help us move, in some sense, to move skillfully, you know, toward food and away from predators and to hug our friends, as it were. So action's incredibly important. Action's going to leave more of a trace than simply, you know, conceptual thinking. So that's part one. And then part two, service itself. And there's a lot of research on this that shows that action tends to leave, you know, significant neural traces, and people learn more by doing, generally speaking, than they do by simply theoretically contemplating doing something. All right. Part two, service itself and other types of loving kindness or compassion or caring, broadly defined, about other people, love, broadly defined. Love is really good for the brain for many reasons. What I mean by that is that, first of all, research has shown that when people engage compassion practices, a couple things happen in the brain. One is they activate the social system in the brain. So the act of feeling caring about others lights up the same systems that are involved in feeling cared about, because love is love whether it's flowing in or flowing out. So we get a double bonus. When we focus on the experience of caring for others, we strengthen those neural circuits, and simultaneously those neural circuits are shared by other networks that are involved with feeling cared about. So by being loving toward others, we end up feeling more loved ourselves, which is a nice bonus. Second, the acts of caring tend to activate motor systems in the brain, simply calling up the felt sense of compassion, like may you not suffer, thoughts of compassion or warm-hearted feelings of compassion, also send ripple effects into the motor systems of the brain that start readying to act. They get ready to help those that we have compassion for. So there too, we are strengthening those neural circuits. Anytime you stimulate a neural network, particularly if you do so in this more enriched form that I was talking about in the HEAL acronym, so you stay with it and it's intense and felt in the body and enacted as well, hopefully. Anyway, anytime you stimulate a neural network, you tend to strengthen it, since, you know, neurons that fire together wire together. So by engaging acts of service, you know, you strengthen the inclination toward that in the brain. And, you know, it's interesting, too, as you probably know, Bill, and others maybe on this call, research has shown that if you give, you know, college sophomores, the great guinea pigs of social science, if you give them an opportunity to just take $20 for themselves or give that $20 to some nonprofit, some charity, their pleasure centers in their brain, on average, activate more intensively by giving that to other people. Which is really interesting, isn't it, to think about our nature as human beings?
Well, that reminds me of I've been fortunate to be involved in some generosity and service workshops with high schools, local high schools, and And one Waldorf high school we were at, we worked with the senior class, and we took a half an hour, 45 minutes to actually go out into the streets of San Francisco and West Portal to do random acts of kindness. And the kids were just on fire, and you could just feel, you know, some of the kids did inner to outer sanitation where they actually went out and cleaned the streets. Others took out, you know, big signs of smile and were out on the streets, you know, waving to cars coming by. And then others were actually writing thank you notes to shopkeepers and just connecting with everyday people on the street. And it was just so heartwarming. And when they came back, they said, you know, this isn't fair that we just get to do this. You know, our whole school should be doing this. And to me, it's this kind of, it amplifies when you're in a group setting too, you know, whether it's a meditation, you know, kind of one of our awaken meditation evenings together, you know, or actually together doing random acts of kindness. It's just amazing how it amplifies, and it feels like that heal process is in work at that time.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's so sweet. And as a quick point in passing, you know, I think of the ways in which adolescents don't get many opportunities to contribute, and I think that just is what's heart sore in a lot of people, thwarted opportunities for contribution, for love, and giving people those opportunities is a gift to them. And then, of course, receiving their service is also a gift back, because if we don't receive these acts of kindness, if we don't, you know, do our part to receive generosity, then that interrupts the flow, the circle, you know, of the Donna economy. The other quick point, though, and I want to really emphasize this because it's been a deep, deep teaching for me. It's not enough to just have these experiences in the mind of generosity or gratitude or service or love for others. We must also install them. We must also help them sink in. Otherwise, they don't have much, if any, lasting value. And that's something I just want to really call out. And I think that there are many opportunities in work with other people and working with ourselves to take that 10 seconds, that little pause to be the sponge. You know, it's the sponge moment where, you know, SpongeBob, I don't know, it's the sponge moment where you just kind of let it sink in. And it's a great gift to yourself built into that moment of taking it in, which we can also encourage in other people, such as at the end of a meditation session or at different moments during a class or after coming back from service work or having a moment of contact in the eyes with someone and actually registering the experience rather than defending against it or pushing it away or moving on to the next, you know, gotta get it done, you know, take that moment to let it sink in, you know. And if we do that, then we will gradually fill up our own personal hole in the heart.
Well, that brings up a question for me. I tend to be kind of a loner, but I notice that people often gather together for ritual and ceremony, and it's made me kind of interested in the effects of collective or group consciousness. Do you think that group experience can have a more profound effect on one's mental state and neurology than just solitary experience?
That's really interesting. You know, on the one hand, if you look at most historical examples of people having breakthroughs of some kind or another, whether it's a creative breakthrough or it's a spiritual or existential breakthrough, you know, including examples of Zen, people in Zen, you know, with Satori, what have you. Usually it's when people are by themselves, if you think about it. Or they might be in a crowded, busy street about to get onto a bus, but they're surrounded by strangers. On the one hand. So as an introvert myself, I think there's been a little bit of a pendulum push recently about the primacy of relationships and, you know, in life and altogether. And that meme has been largely pushed by the extroverts for whom relationships really are so primary. But I think there are a lot of people that for whom, you know, experiences on their own can be really impactful. Probably one of the most favorite things I love doing is being alone in the wilderness, off trail, for example. I just really enjoy that. That really feeds me in a deep, deep way, on the one hand. On the other hand, I think it's also true that we're deeply social animals. The brain has tripled in volume, essentially, since our ancestors about 2.5 million years ago first began manufacturing stone tools, with a brain a third our size. And much of that tripling of volume is devoted to social skills, broadly defined, and has been driven by the evolution of the brain in the last several million years, definitely, has been driven primarily by the adaptation to group living. In other words, it's really quite profound to appreciate how much that our brains, and therefore our minds, are really about living and cooperating with other people in small bands, typically, 30 to 70 members, roughly, and then getting a little bit larger as agriculture came in, or a lot larger, but that's only 10,000 years ago. We're mostly used to living in small groups. So the net of all that is that we're designed to be influenced by group experiences, of making music together, for example, or moving together as in dance, singing together, or being in a session or a setting where people are focused on a single activity, planning an event, celebrating something that's happened, grieving a loss, or like a funeral or a memorial or a wedding, a celebration of a different kind or a christening, what have you, or meditation. So the research on that's a little hard to do in terms of the brain because it's hard to hook people up, while they're doing some kind of group activity together. Right. But generally speaking, there are examples of where people's brain systems do tend to get entrained with each other. There are studies now being done on simultaneous MRIs, functional MRIs of people who are interacting with each other. So, the bottom line in the natural frame, if the mind changes, the brain has to change. And that means that if the minds of many people are getting synchronized with each other, their brains must be getting synchronized as well.
Mm. That's wow. Exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And for better or worse. I mean, there are many examples, unfortunately. Think about True Believers, Eric Hoffer's book, or I was in Germany. I lived there for a year, and I was there again recently. And there's a lot of recognition of the impact, for example, in Hitler and others, where people, join together in terms of their tribe and wreak havoc, on the world. So this group entrainment capacity in the human brain can, used for good or for ill.
Thank you, Rick. This has been amazing listening to you. I'm trying to install all these good feelings that I'm getting by listening to you.
That's great. Thank you.
Thankfully, there is a recording, so I'll definitely listen to it. I just wanted to make sure, Rick, I understood this correctly, that so the way to install this good thought is to actually take a moment and sit still and actually feel it when it's happening? Is that what you recommended? I just want to make sure, Rick.
Yes. The short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is to have it and enjoy it, and especially enjoy it. And you can enjoy it in the flow. You can enjoy it while, as I think Bill brought it up earlier, while you're taking action. For example, you could enjoy brushing your child's hair, or you could enjoy walking down the street with other people you're working with to help others. You can enjoy it while you're doing it. With a little bit of, it's what's interesting is that what people bump into when they first start trying to do this, to actually internalize the experience, to feed themselves, right, in some fundamental way, to feed themselves emotionally and psychologically, and to learn good lessons. I'm applying this approach not just to moments of gratitude or things like that, but to really registering skills. Like, this is how to be or to operate or function with this kind of person in this kind of setting to a better result in the future. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or this is what it feels like to feel very grounded and centered and strong in my body while also asserting myself with another person, speaking truth to power. That's what that feels like. I really want to let this one sink in. Or maybe there's a kind of shift spiritually for a person where they have an opening into a new way to relate to the passing thoughts and feelings, in the stream of consciousness, and they want to really help that land. That's what I'm really talking about here. And as you start doing it, one of the things you bump into are the blocks to doing it. I don't deserve this, what have you. But with a little practice, you'll start getting good at it. And if I was to really summarize it all, mo better. In other words, more episodes over the flow of a day, you know, 5, 10 or more over a day, more episodes of internalizing a useful experience. And then inside episodes, mo beta. In other words, the richer the experience, the more intensely it's felt in the body, the longer it lasts, the better it'll be in terms of growing neural structure. That's easy to remember. Mo beta.
Okay, definitely. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's important, though, in order for you to install it, that you're aware, fully aware at that moment and enjoying it, and not like if I'm brushing my daughter's hair, I'm not thinking of that I need to get to work. But if I'm doing that, then I can't really, I'm not really enjoying that experience, right?
So. Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the things, I know I want to make space for other people to talk. I'll be super short here. You may know there's this so-called hell realm in Tibetan Buddhism called the Land of the Hungry Ghosts. And it's this idea of these somewhat quite very powerful beings who unfortunately are represented with bellies that are enormous to show their appetites, but their mouths through which they receive the things that they crave are tiny pinholes. And I think of that a lot, honestly, as many people in the developed countries of the world, certainly in America, my home country, in which isn't it ironic that surrounded by pleasures of all kinds, the typical person in America lives better than the kings and queens of old, just in everyday life, in terms of things like pain control, flush toilets, refrigeration, media, you know, and so forth. And yet, there's still this incredible hunger for more and more and more. And I think it's very poignant. If we, on the other hand, actually registered the felt sense of basic needs met when they are met, and registered the felt sense of being safe when we actually are safe, and registered the felt sense of being connected when we actually are connected, which is to say, truly, much of the time in the lives of most people, unfortunately not all, obviously, but in the lives of most people, our basic needs tend to be quite routinely met. If we were to actually take in that experience and register it, we would increasingly not get so aggressive toward other people. We would not be so driven and hungry for consumerism that's heating up our planet and, you know, killing off all kinds of other species. And we would not feel so lonely and disconnected from other people, because we would have internalized again and again and again, in spite of the brain's negativity bias, the felt sense of core needs met. And that's one of my hopes for this world, you know, that we can get a billion or more brains, some tipping point of brains, with an ongoing felt sense of core needs met, so we're not so focused around those ancient powers of fear, frustration, and heartache.
Wow. Thanks so much. Sounds so straightforward.
Yeah, one synapse at a time, one brain at a time, one breath at a time, right? Okay, how about some comments from people?
Hi, I loved listening to you, especially the point where you say that, you know, just seeking high with happiness is not enough. I mean, you know, to make it more profound, you need to really install it and internalize it. Love that, really. My question was, do you have any suggestions or tools to, you know, convert your negative thoughts to positive thoughts? That would be good if you can shed light on that. Thank you so much. Thank you for all your insights.
Oh, thank you. And, briefly on that, I think first surface the negative thoughts and try to step back from them. You know, it's a little bit like, as it were, people say the voice in the back of the head. Very normal. We're not crazy. You know, it just murmurs away. And the problem is not so much the voice in the back of the head. The problem is that we think the voice in the back of the head is me. You know, right? And the trick is to not think that it's me, but to, in the technical term, disidentify from it, kind of detach from it, and more observe it in a neutral way, as if it's, the way I think of it, frankly, is that, you know, the brain is this vast network. It's very distributed. So I think of the mind in some ways like a village or a committee. In other words, with multiple voices. So there you are, let's say, in a committee, you know, and there are many voices at the table. They all belong there. They're part of the committee. But you know there are some of those voices in almost any committee that internally you're thinking, okay, I know where you're coming from. I've heard this before. It you got a good heart, your intentions are good. Every voice inside our mind has good intentions, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's also important to appreciate. It's trying to help us survive in one way or another, as it very narrowly conceives of that survival and the means to the ends of that survival, right? So everybody on the committee is well-intended, but do you believe what every member of the committee says? Do you always agree with every member on the committee? And certain voices, as soon as they start talking, you say to yourself, oh, yeah, that's Bob. I know he's got that weird trip, you know, and I'm just fine, Bob. Anything else new, you know? Thank you for sharing. We're going to keep moving along here, right? That's how to be, you know, with some of those negative thoughts, I think. And little tricks you can play is to see them as absurd. You can also start recognizing ways in which they've been stuck into your brain, unfortunately installed, because installation goes both ways, and we've got a brain that's biased toward negative installations. That's the negativity bias. So, you know, those voices got stuck in, and you kind of see as, oh, that's my big brother. Oh, that's the nun that I went to, you know, parochial school with. Oh, that's the media voice yammering away at me. I don't need to take it so seriously. So you can do all those things. And then, even more, you can argue against it. You can say, no, actually, that's not true. It's as if you have inside yourself not just critical, doubting, fear-provoking, or greedy voices, right? But you have voices inside that are, I call it my caring committee, my internalized committee of voices that nurture me, that encourage me, that are strong on my own behalf. You know, on my caring committee, I have like that fairy godmother in Sleeping Beauty, the Disney cartoon film, if people have seen that, you know, it's kind of plump and nurturing. I also have rock climbing guides I've gone out with and football coaches I've known that are fierce. They're not, but they're on my side. You know what I mean? That's the thing. Everybody in your caring committee is on your side. And on your side, they stick up for you and they speak back to those internalized oppressors, using that language from diversity work, those internalized oppressors that are not your friends. So I guess that's what I would say right there in terms of what you can do. And then as you go through life, you can, again, take in the good. You can repeatedly internalize the felt sense of the caring committee. You can increasingly form conviction about, you can take in the good of the thoughts that come from the caring committee, the viewpoints, the beliefs that are expressed by the caring committee. You can take those in as well. And you can also take in the felt sense of what it's like to separate from these old negative false voices, what that's like as well. See, when I talk about happiness, I really use that term very broadly to really mean inner strengths, including the kinds of inner strengths that I've just talked about in the last 30 seconds.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, one thing you can also do is write these things down. That's quite powerful. You know, it's a classic cognitive therapy technique to draw a line down the middle of the page on the label it wrong thought, right thought, the two columns, and then put that belief into the wrong thought column and then come up with three or more rebuttals to it in the right thought column, rebuttals that you actually can believe in, and then start practicing that. If you do that repeatedly, that too is something that's quite powerful. And again, you can take in the felt sense of the truth of the right thoughts. So you develop, so you grow your conviction about them.
Hi, this is Dan from Connecticut, and I'm really enjoying this call. Thank you so much. I remember a wonderful moment from the movie Eat, Pray, Love, where our main character is in Italy, and she's admonished by a barber who says, "Oh, you Americans, You only want entertainment. You know nothing about pleasure." And that line really stuck with me because I interpret entertainment as distraction. It seems to me that we are always going after shiny objects, that we have this addiction to something that will just take us out of ourselves and someplace else. And yet, we seem to pull away from real, honest, deep-in-the-bones pleasure. I think there really is a difference. I wonder if you see a distinction, and could you speak a little bit more about why that happens?
I think that's genius. Take that in. Really, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, there's an old line, you can never get enough of what you don't really want. right? And so I think, you know, we're caught up, again, in especially consumer-based economies like Western economies. You know, we tend to be very caught up in, to use your distinction, entertainments of various kinds or hoped-for entertainments, which tend to routinely disappoint, which then keep us driven toward, you know, the promise of future entertainments, again, like those hungry ghosts, you know, roaming the universe with pinhole mouths and big fat bellies full of appetite. And yet, in the moment, it's so amazing to really watch your own mind and how hard it is for a typical person trained toward just seeking, 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 how hard it is to just take a moment to let the feeling of the warm water on your back in a shower really sink in. Elemental physical pleasures, the pleasure of drinking water when you're thirsty, or taking a coat off if you're a little too warm, or the pleasure of looking in the eyes of another person and really feeling seen in that moment, or the pleasure of accomplishing something, like literally putting a, you know, cleaning a dish or getting a child to bed. And I think you're exactly right. These are the deep pleasures, including sensual pleasures that are wholesome and appropriate in everyday life, or subtle pleasures of the mind, to really let them sink in. It's remarkably hard for many people to actually enjoy something for 10 seconds straight, to protect that experience inside their own mind. Try to do it. And even see if you can get up to 20 seconds straight of just enjoying. And do it with food. Food is a good one because it's easy to enjoy something sweet, especially, or some food you like. Just stay with it in your mouth for 10 or 20 seconds straight. That's good training. And you can then apply it to other, you know, maybe more subtle enjoyments as well. But I think you're genius. I think you're exactly right. And interestingly, as we gradually take in these true pleasures, we get less and less caught up in craving. Less and less caught up in, you know, going to war with what's unpleasant or grasping after what's pleasant or clutching at what's heartfelt. And we become increasingly free in the world and much less easily manipulated by fear or desire, which are the two classic, you know, manipulations, or manipulated around group identity. The three classic manipulations, you know, of ruling elites over, you know, recorded history certainly, and probably before that as well.
Well, that answer's genius. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thank you. You know, these days, to feel already satisfied is almost like civil disobedience. You know, there's the culture.
Thank you, Jen.
Yes, nice interaction. I think part of what I was going to ask may have been answered by the couple of previous callers. But, Rick, as you, you know, look at seeking pleasure, how do you reconcile the polarity that exists between achieving and belonging?
Can you say another sentence and why you see, or the ways in which you see a polarity, and perhaps also the ways in which you see a synergy between the two?
You know, generally, if you look at the motivation of individuals, the desire to achieve and stand out and accomplish, more often than not, comes in conflict with belonging to the community in which that achievement occurs, or it could. And when you do that, when you achieve, it feels like, okay, it's fun, and you hold that achievement and the satisfaction that comes from it for 10, 15 seconds. But then after a while, you look back at it and say, that one, was it as good for me as it was, or was it as good for others as it was for me? And then you have second and third order questions about, is there any fun in really holding that sense of achievement in your head, which creates that sense of separation, if you will? And if you go back to that kind of a mental model, anything that feels really good and you hold the thought in your head and you give it more life, it creates more separation. How do you reconcile with, okay, ultimate happiness is not in seeking separation, but being one with everything?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm going to respond here, and I'm going to reflect more on this, because I think you're raising something really important and deep. So I've reflected on this a lot myself, because I'm very engaged in accomplishment, right, in many kinds of ways. And I'm simultaneously, or at least I try to be on my good days, a reasonably Buddhist kind of person who's quite aware of the perils in craving in ways large and small, so gross and subtle, especially the subtle ones, the ones that are harder to see. So I think I get at this by starting with what I call the friend test. In other words, imagine someone outside me who is my friend, or just someone I see, you know, that I have goodwill toward, or which includes people in general. What would I wish for that person? Well, if I see my friend, and my friend has certain capabilities, let's say my friend really wants to get a new program going in a school, or my friend wants to become trained at a higher level as a teacher, or let's say my friend has a musical talent, or is verbally gifted, or just has a certain amount of energy, it loves to cook, it wants a family, I would wish for my friend that he or she actually can accomplish those things. They're wholesome. I don't wish for my friend that she builds landmines, you know, or hurts children, sure. But in normal range accomplishments, starting a business, a little bakery, developing a shop, making a song, writing a poem, I would wish for that person to be able to accomplish those things. You know, there's a place for accomplishment. Accomplishment, broadly defined, in ways large and small, is one of the fundamental ways we feel like we're making a contribution to the world and also fulfilling our own capabilities and actualizing ourselves. So I wish those things for my friend. Now, obviously, anything, including simply being inert, has pitfalls. There are pitfalls in the drive toward accomplishment. I actually wrote one of my little Just One Things. This is this free newsletter I do called Just One Thing. One of them was called Aspire Without Attachment, and that kind of sums it up for me. Or to put it a little differently, to quote Ajahn Chah, a great Thai Buddhist teacher, to tend to the causes without getting attached to the results. We can't control the results, but we do have some influence over the causes that we tend to. So I think there's a place for appropriate aspiration and appropriate achievement or accomplishment. And so if it would be wholesome to wish that for my friend, right, I can certainly have the benevolence to wish it for myself. Why am I, there's a term in psychology, negative grandiosity. You know, why are the general principles of decency and fairness and benevolence that would be applied to my friend, why am I the exception to them? I'm not, obviously. That's part one. Then part two, you're exactly right, and it's really quite poignant that sometimes our own achievements or accomplishments separate us from other people, or they can do that, certainly. One of the pitfalls on our side is we can get caught up in subtle forms or gross forms of narcissism and grandiosity. Look at me, I have the best bakery in the world, you know, or look at me, I write the best books about the brain in America, or something like that, right? We have to be very, very careful about that. The subtleties of egoity and self-referential processing are really quite extraordinary. I think it's interesting as a model in Buddhism, the fourth and final stage of awakening, and that's all seen essentially in Buddhism, especially early Buddhism, inside a natural frame. There's nothing metaphysical or supernatural going on in this life. And that fourth stage is the stage of the actual release of the self-conceit. It takes the fourth stage of awakening to completely let go of egoity. So it speaks to how, you know, much of a challenge it is on the one hand. On the other hand, the truth is also a lot of the issues around accomplishment come from other people, and that's their trip, frankly. Maybe they feel envious or less than or outcompeted with, and we can have compassion for them about that. We can certainly check ourselves. Did I play by the rules when I accomplished things? Were my motives wholesome? Or certainly at least did I have wholesome motives mixed up with narcissistic motives? So even if I did have narcissistic motives, there were wholesome motives as well that still would have taken me to this result. We can ask ourselves that. But we can also separate from the envy or jealousy or sadness of others, and we can recognize, you know, I would not want to create a world in which people did not have the chance to pursue their wholesome aims and desire for wholesome accomplishment and achievement. I would not want to have that world, right? And I'm willing to accept the price that other people feel who did not get the job we competed with them for, right? Or who did not win the race that we ran and we won it. I can have compassion for what it's like for them, but also recognize that the greater good for the world altogether is served by creating opportunities for people to really have the chance to accomplish and achieve what they're fully capable of. And to me, net, bottom line, that creates a better world for all of us.
Cool. Thank you.
Hi, this is Mani in Bangalore. Thank you. Wonderful call. I have a quick question. When you talked about introvert and extrovert, I try to work with my kids in terms of installing and enriching and absorbing these kind of elemental pressures that we talked about.
Yeah.
Can we speak to a little bit, how do we do that with kids that we have, which is, to me, slightly different than introvert and extrovert conversation, because to me, I see them as part of me, but also I need to be an extrovert to install that. And if you can speak to that in the context of the multimodality that you mentioned in the enrichment, that'll be helpful. Thank you.
Could you say more, I don't quite get it, about the introvert-extrovert distinction you're drawing?
Introvert, extrovert, to me, it's either working with yourself or working with others. And in that sense of the term, to me, my kids are extension of me. That's
okay.
I mean that.
That's clear now. so it's fine to use words, obviously, in different ways. You know, language is very flexible. That said, in psychology, in its origins, introvert and extrovert are seen as internal characteristics of a person. And the distinction, you know, to simplify, is between people who are mainly fed by solitude and drained in contact versus people who are fed by contact and they feel drained in solitude. I'm an introvert. My primary wellsprings are achieved through kind of being by myself, although I'm certainly fed by others, but you know, I really like doing things on my own. My wife is a total extrovert. She's really fed by contact, and just being alone for her feels kind of draining. Okay, so with regard to children, you're right. In some sense, it's an extroverted kind of activity to interact with them as a parent, a father, or a mother. And there's something interpersonal that's going on there. But that said, two introverts could, in principle, interact with each other, much as two extroverts could interact with each other, or an extrovert and an introvert. So to bottom line it, what I find with children is that slowing things down enough for them to really register the felt sense of a positive experience in their bodies, in terms of multimodality, as you're saying, is really, really important. And a wonderful opportunity for that is just before bed. It's also true that some kids who are extroverts tend to be having one positive experience after another. Research shows that extroverts tend to be happier than introverts, you know, on average. On the other hand, extroverts tend to zoom along from one thing to another. So the positive experiences they are having are not sinking in, whereas introverts might not be having as many positive experiences. Introverts tend to brood on negative things, speaking from personal experience. But on the other hand, when introverts do have a positive experience, they're more capable of letting it sink in. I find myself, to sum up, with children, I work with kids, and I've raised them, you know, to adulthood. I find that a little bit of talk about the brain is really helpful. They love hearing about it. Oh, Velcro for negative, Teflon for positive. They get that immediately. Or maybe some culturally relevant, different metaphor, perhaps. And then they don't want to have that. And also kids tend to not like being bossed around by other people because they get bossed around by people all day long, including their father, speaking of my children. So they like the idea that they're in charge of their own minds and their brain and to be challenged. Look, your brain is constantly changing its structure. The only question is, who's doing that change? Is it you or the forces outside you that are not so good for you? And instead, you can take charge of those structure-building processes on the inside out, and the opportunity to do that is, you know, a half dozen or a dozen times a day when you can actually take in the good. I find when I say that to kids, they get really motivated around it.
Thank you, Rick.
That's great.
Okay. Thank you.
And may I say this really fast about kids or others, and you can apply this, what I'm saying about taking the good, as a teacher or a therapist or a coach or as a leader or a trainer. And I think, first of all, to go back to some of what I think is implied in the previous question, in my view, we're influencing other people all day long. So in principle, it's okay to influence others. They're influencing us. Going to Bill's point in the very beginning, we're very profoundly social animals. We evolved to influence others and to be influenced by them. The question is, are we doing it ethically and skillfully, right? And so I think it's okay to influence our children or to influence the people we teach or work with, what have you, but we have to be asking, are we ethical and skillful? In that context, presuming we are, I think really fast there are four ways to do taking in the good with other people. I'll just name them really quickly. The first way is to just do it implicitly. For example, with children, we just slow it down to let useful, positive things really have a chance to sink in. Second way is we teach it explicitly. We tell them how to do it, use the HEAL process, H-E-A-L, have, enrich, absorb, and if you want, link, etc., to both activate a useful mental state and then install it as a neural trait. And then we let them do with whatever they do with it. The third way is we teach it explicitly and we actually take people through it. Very deliberately, you know, calling it out, we walk them through it, right? And then the fourth way we use any kind of method with people, including taking the good, is we name it, we teach it explicitly, and then we encourage them to do it on their own, okay? And so that's just a way to think about how to use these methods with other people.
Thank you so much.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I didn't get the cue, I'm sorry. Thank you so much. The last, what you just said is very relevant to what I was about to ask. I actually have two questions. One is, I have spent a lot of my adult life involved in what I call transformational global leadership coaching and training, and then also global citizenship. What does it take to have the mindset and to act appropriately as a global citizen, somebody who's relating to the whole of the planet so we can create a more sustainable environment for all of us? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that and what we can do to support that or build that awareness, capacity, sensitivity. And then second, over the past few years, I have personally been developing, through a lot of different reasons, experiences of very intense pain in the spine and neurological. And that's something that is the primary thing that takes me out of anything I'm interested in and anything that I have capacity for. I was just interested if you have any specific insights on how to deal with very specific physical pain, other than, you know, doing the doctors and finding out what's going on and all of that, which I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, okay, a lot there. I'll be quick. In reverse order, first of all, you know, I'm sorry you've got that pain, and pain is very debilitating. You know, it's interesting. Studies show that chronic pain is one of the most pernicious factors in a person's well-being and also in their relationships. And I don't say that to be gloomy, but rather to have my voice join other voices in your own internal caring committee, Michelle, and for others who have this issue, to realize that, okay, we've got a real challenge here, and I need to increase resources to match my challenges. Otherwise, I'm going to be, you know, outgunned, as it were. So that's part one. And in terms of doing that, then there's a lot of research. I would look into MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which originated for chronic pain. And there are a lot of related forms of mental training that, if you don't know about, are really great resources for dealing with pain. And,
yeah, can you say that again? I don't know. Yep. I didn't recognize that.
Oh, then this will be a good one for you then. Yeah. MBSR, uh-huh. Mindfulness-based stress reduction.
Oh, okay. Then yep. I'm more familiar with it than when you say it that way. But go ahead. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of good stuff there, and I'll leave it at that because I want to make time here for the second part of your question. And I really wish you the best with that. But there's a lot of research that shows that if people really do engage those forms of mental training, they can really shift their quality of life. Okay. Then global leadership, that's a huge question. A couple things about that. First, the recognition that it's important to think globally is itself something we can take in. There are different components to experience we can take in to really register and develop conviction about, let's say, in this case, a particular thought or viewpoint. Other things we can take in are bodily states or emotions and so forth. So that's part one. part two, I think a lot about the ancient teaching about the two wolves in the heart, you know, the one of love and the one of hate, frankly, and the ways in which, as humans evolved, in general, we evolved to be both very cooperative within bands and also, frankly, competitive and often aggressive and certainly fearful, typically, between bands. There's some exceptions. You know, hominid bands did trade with each other, early human bands. But, you know, the stranger was often an enemy. So the question then becomes, these days, with 7 billion people in a leaky lifeboat, planet Earth, how do we expand the circle of us to include all of them, right? We may still compete with others in healthy ways. We still advocate our own interests. If we're in a race, you know, and we're 10 years old, we still want to win the race, even though that means that other people will not win the race. That's okay for the sake of the greater good. But that said, it's not so easy to expand that circle of us. So I've thought a lot about that from an evolutionary standpoint, and I have two suggestions that people, you know, these are not original suggestions, but I've given some thought as to why they're so important. One is to think about other people as children or their own children or the children of those other people or the way they feel about their children. Because even though adults who are not us are threats, the children of them are not threats to us. And we tend to be deeply, deeply moved by other people's children. That's why I think so many ads for NGOs worldwide, particularly relief organizations, use pictures of children to motivate action. I'm going to Haiti in about 2 months to visit a child, a young woman now, who has been the person I've been in relationship with regard to this charity or nonprofit that we've supported there in Haiti. So in any case, seeing others as children, I think that's really profound and important and possible. And then the second thing, obviously, is to have direct experiences of these other people. Lots of research shows that it's when we have direct encounters. You know, we break bread, we dig a ditch, we tell a joke. You know what I mean? We start a project together. We live with them. We spend a month, you know, living in the back room or even a night. That's when we tend to see others as us. We participate with them. And I think more opportunities to do that, including online, you know, virtual opportunities where we see video clips of other people talking and what their real lives are. That, I think, is another way to really build up that felt sense of interdependence with others. And then I think the last thing I'll say really fast is that, you know, the circle of us shrinks down when we feel that one of or more of our core needs is not met, our needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection, which link to the ancient reptilian, mammalian, and primate stages of evolution, you know, the inner lizard, mouse, and monkey within us all, and therefore our deep needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. So when people feel that their deep needs are challenged, that circle of us gets very small, and people start looking for other members, you know, of us to go to war with them or to protect oneself from them. So by repeatedly internalizing the felt sense of those core needs being met, you know, feeling basically safe, basically satisfied, and basically connected, not in a perfect world, but there's enough, there's a sufficiency. We can afford to move into the green zone, as it were, out of the red zone, in which we feel like one or more of our core needs is not taken care of. Well, when we repeatedly internalize from the inside out, therefore increasingly unconditionally, not based on external conditions, that felt sense of dealing with life from within the green zone, then that enables us more and more effectively to expand the circle of us to include ultimately the whole wide world. And that's where, for me, taking in the good is both personal and political. Through repeatedly internalizing the felt sense through, you know, half a dozen or dozen or more positive experiences a day of core needs being met, we both fill up our own cup for our own healing and well-being and effectiveness and even the upper reaches of human potential for ourselves individually. But we also do this as a political act because it enables us to be more generous, large-hearted, cooperative with others, and to be more grounded in, as I began this call with, the Donna economy of fundamental generosity, particularly in, as it were, the space of service, you know, bringing it back to service space, the frame in which we're doing this call.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, Kanchan, thank you. Rick, my heart is overflowing with gratitude to you and the community. As you were sharing, something came up that I wanted to offer. It's a quote that goes something like, you know, our friends in our life are like the stars. We may not see them always, but in our heart of heart, we know that they are there always.
That's very beautiful. And,
Thank you. So I think I will sit with my question, reflect on it a little bit more, and I'll put it out there. I know we are short on time, but if there is something, one or two words that comes up, please share. The question is, you know, I seem to find myself a lot of the time in the space of unknown, in space of I don't know state. One such state is this understanding around the roots of what we call as the mind. Where is it, and how, in the spirit of how do we nourish once we know where the roots are?
Wow, that's a deep one, and super succinctly. I think partly it depends on what we mean by that slippery word, mind. And I myself usually use that word mind in a conventional naturalistic sense, you know, as neuropsychologists would, as basically the entirety of the information processing in the nervous system, most of which is unconscious. And so in my own practice of meditation and just in life in general, consistent with, I think, traditional teachings, and also many of the world's contemplative traditions, increasingly I try to relax and open out into the mind flow altogether, and become increasingly disidentified with any single object of consciousness, a sight, a sound, a thought, a feeling, a desire, what have you, wholesome or unwholesome, and increasingly rested in the flow of consciousness altogether. And that, I would say, is very much my practice inside a naturalist frame. And it seems appropriate to close here with a comment that it's also true for me that I'm also engaging practice in which I'm trying to open to and increasingly have an intuition of, if not even a sense of, unconditionality that eternally precedes, you know, any conditioned manifestations, including mind, in that natural definition that I'm using here as, you know, mental neural processing. And so it's a twofer for me. It's opening out into allness in a natural frame, and then being open to an intuition of the unconditioned transcendental frame in which, in my view, the natural unfolding of wholeness occurs in ways that remain very mysterious to me still, and I think truly to other people as well. All that said, this is something, too, that we can let sink in. And maybe I could close here with a quote from the Buddha, which seems very relevant to this whole thing. He taught, "Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good."
And to that end, Rick, also deeply touched by that the model that you shared about the accept, witness, observe, cleanup and cultivation. That is beautiful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. And on behalf of Bill, too, Bill and I, just thank you, Rick, so much. And all of the callers for so many beautiful reflections and insights. That was just that's such a rich hour and a half to spend together. And a question for you, Rick, is there any way that our service-based community can be of service to you in your efforts?
Oh, you're very kind. Well, I'll tell you honestly something that I'm going to do, and you could help me spread the word about it. And so I'm going to do an annualized program around taking in 12 essential strengths. And I'll probably launch it toward the around September of 2014, so about 9 months or so from now. And I will offer it for a fee, a very low fee for a year-long program. But I will also offer it, consistent with my own background and that of many others, for a full or for a partial or full scholarship. So fundamentally, anyone can take this program for free. Fundamentally, it'll be web-based, and so it'll be international, and it'll be accessible, and it will be really, really rich in terms of the cultivation of these 12 core strengths, which include things like love and generosity and letting go and so forth. So when the time comes, if you all would be willing to just put the word out about it, that I would be grateful for that, knowing that, again, no one will be turned away for lack of funds, as it were, in the traditional formulation. Anyone can do this for free. And, you know, if they want to pay for it as well, they could do that too. But that would be a help to me.
Wonderful. And what did you call it? What is the course called, or your annual?
Yeah, I think it'll be called the 12 Essential Strengths.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
wonderful.
And I'll let you know when it happens. And again, I stress the point that from the standpoint of benevolence, you know, my own desire is to make these tools and teachings, skillful means, as widely available as possible, including for people of very different cultures than my own, and completely accessible, like I say, absolutely free for anyone who wants access to this program. So if you can help me in that sharing of these skillful means, I would appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.